God, I thank you for this family. I thank you for blessing us with children. It's a pretty special thing, pretty spectacular thing that we are blessed with children. And I thank you for that. I thank you that you've given us the privilege of being stewards of their lives and cause us to realize that this last half hour and whatever time we spend with them this morning is important. It's important, our responses to them, how we represent you to them. Because it's not about what we teach them in Sunday school as much as it is how we live our lives. So God, I ask you to give us hearts towards the children. Jesus, you had a heart towards children and realized that is the baseline and the core for the next generation of representing your character and nature on the earth, and pretty critical. And you made the statement that it's better if we cause one of these children to stumble, it'd be better if a millstone were tied around our neck and we'd be thrown into the depths of the sea. That's a pretty extreme statement. So cause us to love on these kids and give patience and wisdom and long-suffering to Ashley and Jeremy and Becca as they go in, take on the herd. So I ask you to, you know, you tell us to lay hands, the elders lay hands on the sick, and Billy's not here. He's been sick, missed a week of work, and he doesn't miss work, and he doesn't get sick, but obviously he's got his butt kicked pretty hard right now. I don't know why and what and where all this sickness has been, but God, I ask you in the name of Jesus to heal him, to bring him back to restored life so he can work, so he can hunt, so he can be a dad and husband. I'd ask you to protect Jesse and Levi as they're on the way home, I assume, today. You would bless their time, that they would be renewed in their marriage, be renewed in their marriage vows and commitment to each other, be renewed in their perspective on, cause them to realize that taking vacations are not to be hedonistic, pleasure-seeking, selfish people. Taking vacations are to be transformed and be renewed so that we're a greater part of the family and a body, and we bless others. So cause them to consider that as they come home. I thank you for giving us this opportunity to meet together as a body and teach us today. Amen. Hi, Tinley. You got volunteered, Jeremy. Yeah. You got volunteered. You needed some kid time because you haven't had much. You've only got 9 at your house right now, so that's it, you know. Yeah. So, you guys need to shut that door because it's good. Jeremy, you doing it? Jeremy was there. Wondrous thing, these children. It's a wondrous thing. So, I feel like saying thank you all for letting us go on a trip. It was a sweet, sweet time. So, I was hoping to wrestle a grizzly bear or something, you know. Unfortunately, that God said there was other things. It wasn't my time.
So,
we camped at Lake Louise, and there was an electrified bear fence around where we were camping. Yeah, I asked him if they could. I asked them if they could shut it up. They've had some maulings. They've had a few people kind of get chewed on, so they decided they'd do that.
We called them and
were like, "Can you put a fence up?" I was so sad when I drove in there. I went, "Oh no, oh well." Here we are. We saw lots of mountain goats. You know, we saw lots of mountain goats, and we saw elk and deer and antelope and bighorn sheep, and yeah, it was sweet, and a whole bunch of people from other countries. That place is nuts. I mean, English is not the main language. Of course, it's not in Canada anyway, necessarily. Well, Western Canada, they do. Most of the signs start with English, and people do speak English, but there definitely was a lot of people from somewhere else. So, it was interesting because I wanted to see the beauty. I wanted to hang out with my wife and go camping. You know, we've never, both of us have spent a fair amount of time in the hills, but it's always with kids in the last 30 years. So, camping together and hanging out in the tent and cooking and stuff was kind of like, wow, you know. It's pretty wondrous. But, my take was, again, I don't think that it's right. We're not to live our lives for self-pleasure and self-gratification and just to make ourselves happy. You know, what is the purpose of a vacation? You know, I haven't spent a lot of time pondering about that because I haven't done it, you know, doing it. We've always gone to do family events or gone to family or done something, but we've never gone. One other time we went on vacation with the family to Yellowstone, and that was terrible. So I never wanted to do it again after that, I guess. That was that 17 years ago, you said, or something?
2002.
So, yeah. It was the same thing. It was bumper to bumper, and every time a chipmunk crossed the road, everybody stops the cars and gets out and takes pictures and does it. But it's a different, you know, I would say for me what's difficult, it's the same reason that I don't like downhill skiing. You know, I'm an adrenaline boy, you know, I like riding motorcycles fast, and I love the mountains, there's no more beautiful place in the mountains, but I don't like downhill skiing at all, or snowboarding, because I hate being in what I consider, for me, a sacred ground. I mean, when I'm on top of Baldy, I mean, it's just, that's splendor, right? I mean, the view, and it's just gorgeous up there, but you're with 4,700 other people that are you don't even know who they are, and you're back to city mentality to the most part, where you don't connect with everybody, you don't look at each other, you just go past each other and do it. And plus for me, and again, I'm an adrenaline, I'm not knocking it, it's just for me personally, people are up on the mountain to conquer it, you know, people are up on the mountain to dominate it, not necessarily to let it enrich your soul, you know, I think of why God created Banff and Jasper. I mean, have anybody else been there? Have people been to Banff or Jasper? I mean, it's like, it's the real deal. I mean, it's extreme. Yeah, it's like, the sawtooths doesn't get any better than the sawtooths. I mean, the sawtooths are beautiful, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else, honestly. Sawtooths are beautiful, as beautiful. Pioneers, as far as I'm concerned, are my favorite mountains. You know, I love the Pioneers. But it's like that for like 200 miles, you know, or something. And the mountains are pretty, fairly worthless. You know, except to look at. They're extremely moving. and the lakes are like nothing else. I mean, I was telling Micah that the lakes are actually, a lot of lakes are the color of Micah's hat. That blue. No, literally, that blue. I mean, it's like you're just astounded to see it. It's beautiful. And you think, well, why did God do that? You know, why did God, and it's, you know, it's not just that I think they're pretty. It's like there's nobody that isn't going, wow. You know, anybody that looks at it is just stunned. It's a way that it interfaces with the way God created humankind, I think. I think it would be a very depraved soul that wouldn't be moved or inspired by the beauty of that. And it's, why did God do that? You know, why did God make such an extreme? Because it was just kind of his toy, right? I mean, you look at those mountains. I mean, the flood was pretty impressive time to not be around, you know, because you wouldn't want it to have been there, because they're all serious, you know, layered, and then God just said, nope, we're going to... things, just, these mountains came up out of the ground, and I mean, it's just, it's stunning. But to me, the purpose isn't, you know, it better be to move your soul with the grandeur and greatness of God, and the smallness, the minuteness. I mean, that's what the mountains, a big part of them are for me, is when I get on top of the mountain, or like even it's like Boulder or any mountain. It's one of the reasons I love being up there, is you get on top of the mountain, you look around and go, oh, I guess I'm not the center of the world, am I? It's kind of like a big bunch of other places around, and I'm kind of this little bitty speck in the middle of this thing, and I'm not really the most important, and my troubles, it seemed like the world revolves around, really aren't what I think they are. And it's a very good perspective orienter, I guess I'd say. The mountains to me have always been that. And to me, if the mountains don't humble you, you're a fool. You know, the mountains are a place where you can, they will whip your fanny. You know, I mean, there's, you know, that's wild. I mean, there's, you know, 200-foot ice walls, even this time of year still, you know, from the glacier faces that the mountains, the tops of the peaks come together, and they've been sitting snow up there for a long time, and then they kind of get these faces on them that just melt off in the summer, and snow keeps falling on them and keeps building the glacier. And I mean, it's just it's a pretty astounding thing. You know, they're really different, because the mountains they're like all carpeted in green trees. Except for Jasper. Jasper is carpeted in green and brown trees, because it's probably 50% plus of the trees are dead. Like our beetle kill stuff in north. But it's just solid trees. So the mountains go from solid trees, solid, which is kind of non-life inducing, because there's nothing under there to eat, and it's really not good habitat. It's really just, but it's this giant carpeted trees, and then it goes cliffs. You know, they just go up. It's just weird, but it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. My hope was, and I'm still obviously in process, and, you know, we're in process, we're in mourning. No, we're not mourning, we're glad to be here. But we're in process of, you know, being, what is it that we were stirred by? And, you know, part of what I think the reason was going there was just to see the state of our world and where people are, because there's still a lot of people. Fall is like the slow time. But every campsite and every hotel was booked. And there's a lot of them. Okay? There's a few campsites that are closed down. So, you know, but of the ones that are open, they were booked. So there was still a lot of people. Maybe half a summer. I don't know what, you know. There's not as many as in summer, which I can't fathom that. But every turnout, every place that was there was just... people, you know, standing there for the most part, you know, close to the road. I think part of it is there's no place else you can go in the world probably and get that close to that extreme of mountains in a tour bus, in your tennis shoes, you know. You know, it's just a different place. But you know, the state of our, I didn't sense, and I was sharing this morning with some people, I didn't sense anybody or see really anybody walking up and just being moved really by this and just you know, I mean, the instant response is get your phone out, get your camera out. You know, that's everybody. You know, the minute they get out of the car, their phone out and their camera's out and they're doing this. To do what? Selfies. Yeah, everybody selfies. I mean, we took selfies for the first time in our life, you know, doing it. So I guess we were just caught up in the madness or something, huh? It was for our kids, she kept saying, okay, fine. Take a selfie. So it was embarrassing, okay? But I didn't stand out, I can tell you that, you know, in the process on it. So, and we were able to find some places to move that, you know, there was a couple feet of snow up at the top part, and so the trails were pretty icy and pretty snowy, so we were able to hike a couple miles and get away from people. So we had a couple of sweet half days, whatever, you know, where we were all by ourselves, you know. And, you know, a ways away. But the sad thing to me was, again, you know, is, and it's again the same thing on Baldy, is your soul moved and are you humbled by God's grandeur and God's greatness? Again, everybody is designed to be moved by that, by Banff and Jasper. I mean, you know, everybody's response is the same. Ooh, ah, wow. You know, even if I show you pictures of the lakes and the cliffs, you do the same thing. It inspires that in you, the grandeur and the greatness. But what is that? How does that move your soul? How does that change your soul? Does it bring reverence? Does it bring respect? Does it bring humility? Or are you there to take? You know, are you there to take something of it and create, you know, that's not really create envy in other people because you were there. And that is really a big part of where we've gone. I'm sure that Jasper and Bamson's cameras were made were always about cameras, right? Because, I mean, the pictures are just unbelievable. But at this point, there's this whole culture of wanting other people to wish they were me and being here. You know, and rather than going and having yourself become a better human being for standing in the presence of something so magnificent and so great, there's this desire, I'm going to take a picture and show everybody else, so everybody else will be envious of me. You know, and then get back in the bus and go to the next place and take a picture. And go to the next place, take a picture. And go to the next place, take a picture. So I can say, I did this. And it's just, to me, a very, I would contend, a very degenerate state of our culture. Not of our culture, because obviously we were experiencing more of other cultures than ours. You know, there was very little of what I would consider North American, our culture, even there. You know, the vast majority were Oriental of some sort, Taiwanese and Japanese and Chinese. I would say 80%, maybe 70-80% were that, maybe more. And the rest were, you know, Europeans, a lot of English and stuff doing it. But it was, again, what is your reason for being? Same thing with skiing, same thing with hunting. You know, why do we do it? You know, do we go out there to be changed people by what God has made, by the experience that God allows us to have in that? Or we just go to be takers and conquerors, you know? I know when I was a kid, I backpacked a lot. And I always loved the mountains from a young age. And when I was, you know, 14, 15, 16, my friend and I, our parents would go drop us off up in the Sierras, which Sierras are pretty remote and pretty distant mountains. I mean, they're 14,000 foot peaks, you know, and on the east side of the Sierras, pretty rugged stuff, a lot like the Sawtooths. I mean, just extreme beautiful. And we'd backpack for a week or 10 days, the two of us, and come out and I loved it. I loved being back there and I loved backpacking. But that was right about the time in the early 1970 or so, and 71, when all of a sudden the trend became ultralight backpacking, and who can conquer the most miles, and who can conquer the most peaks, and who can have the most 14ers, you know, who can say they did this. And all of a sudden, the people that you would meet in the mountains and the people you'd run into had a whole different tempo and demeanor. They were out to conquer. They had an agenda to do, you know, rather than they're humbled, you know, you're sitting there humbled by this going, oh my gosh, look at this, you know, this is, you know, who am I and what an amazing creator did this. You know, there was none of that. And as we move towards a godless culture, a culture that doesn't believe in Yahweh doing it, I think it's more and more that, you know, it's because it's self-worship. It's about self-worship doing it. And so it's about how do I make myself greater by showing me in this setting, by showing me in this, you know, that I have conquered how many 14ers. I'm not saying it's wrong to go, you know, push yourself and go in the mountains, but there, you know, it's become actually, the ultralight craze has actually become a nutcase thing right now. Who can be the lightest and who can go the farthest and who can do the most? And it's like hunting is that way. You know, look at John and Ray, they're perfect specimens of CrossFit hunters. You know, that's the way it is. But the it's become a thing of, you are, but you know, you do it. But that it's become a thing of, there's a generation now of, you know, 30-year-old stuff that is lost sight of why you're hunting. It's about dominating and, you know, the CrossFit hunters, you know, that we're going to go out and conquer this. And again, being in shape is good, but why do we do what we do every day? Are we moved in the state of our soul? Do we live in this place? God gave us an amazing thing. Look at it outside right now. I mean, there's a couple weeks here where if your soul isn't moved, shame on you. You know, shame on you. I mean, it is just extremely beautiful. I mean, it was so sweet to wake up this morning and hoping that we hadn't missed the fall, because we've been in fall for a week, you know, up there in Banff and stuff. It's been just gorgeous. You know, just beautiful colors, beautiful fall colors. And we were coming down the river through the Bitterroot and stuff was gorgeous doing it. We kept hoping, man, I hope we don't. And Gene decided to take a bunch of side trips yesterday on the way home and delay us getting home. So we were wandering around out in the middle of nowhere, you know, Mud Lake and things like that. And, you know, to wake up this morning and look outside and, you know, I mean, why did God do that? Why did God make the leaves turn like he did? You know, why did he? It's not just evolution. It's not just the way things are. God did it to inspire our souls. And if we do not put ourselves in the state to be moved and inspired by that and become better people because of the golden leaves that are out there, then something's wrong. You know, then something's wrong with our perspective of it. So that's my short come home and talk about life rant. This Exodus, I want to touch base on it. I want to talk about Exodus chapter 2 a little bit today. You know, the first chapter to me is, so far in the last few weeks, the thing that we've looked at, and to me, I hope the thing we take away, and the thing we take away about Exodus, because it's so profound, I think it's more profoundly illustrated than, or as profoundly illustrated as anywhere in the Bible, and particularly in the New Testament, where God has a purpose, and God has a plan, and God isn't negligent, and God isn't not paying attention, and God isn't somewhere else, and God is at work doing that plan. We don't have to worry about, you know, we tend to get so consumed and lost in our world that we think, you know, where's God? And what is happening with us? And you know, has God forgotten me? And we need to realize that God is a very, very attentive Father that always is going to be attuned, always going to be in tune. And our purpose isn't to say, but how come it's not like this? And how come this isn't happening? Because God has always got a plan and play to do it. And looking at the Israelites, you know, when God called Abraham, it's a powerful, relentless story of God preserving and fulfilling his promise as he said he would. This next chapter, we talked about last week before last, about the interface of what it looked like then, and the social and cultural acceptance of murdering their babies, you know, and how that, the relevance of that to us today, and how we find it acceptable. You know, we look at the edict that this Pharaoh had put on in the end of chapter 1. And then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast. This is telling his people this, your neighbors, all the Egyptian people. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is, not just the soldiers, not just the military, not just the cops, everybody, your neighbors, all the people, all the Egyptians, commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. And they accepted that. That was what was happening. We don't know for how long. Years, probably. Should have been 10 years, 20 years. And it never tells us the time where this stopped from the time that they moved out of Israel. Okay? We don't know what happened there. But understand, Moses, when he was born, it was 40 years till he was called, left Egypt, and then another 40 years before he came back to Egypt. So that's 80 more years of doing this, okay, and finding acceptable. God, I'm confident of this, and I'm not a doomsday guy, and I've always been. I grew up in an era of predicting the return of Jesus, that made me very leery about doing that. You know, when I was a kid, Hal Lindsey said, "This is when it will be," and there was many people saying, "By this time it will happen," and all the signs have been done. They've never been done. And with an arrogance that says they didn't know how to read the Bible, but we do now, and we can interpret it, so we can see what's happening. So we know that this is when it's going to happen, and this is the time it's going to happen, right? I mean, it's been like that, you know, my whole life, pretty much, in a very, I would consider, arrogant way. Especially when Jesus said, "No man knows the time." They say, "Oh, no, I don't. I'm not sure what hour it'll be, but I, oh, the day, oh, I'm not sure the day, but the week, I can tell you, you know." I mean, it's just bad. And it was all a lie. I mean, if they were Old Testament prophets, they're supposed to be stoned, okay? Because they were false prophets in doing it. But relentlessly predicting it's going to happen now. I don't know when it's going to happen. But if I would be so bold as to make some prediction, we in this country are in trouble. I don't think that God will continue to tolerate what we are doing and how we are being. We are a mess. You know, that was another revelatory part, not revelatory, but just shocking in our face. You know, most of the time we were camping and gone, but there was a couple of afternoons that we went to find a good local brewery that had some local people in it and see if we could talk to some locals about life, you know, doing it. It was just tragic, you know, to speak to the, you know, we met some good people, you know, met some really good people, but the state we're at in this country, I mean, the Kavanaugh thing to me is just revelatory of our state of being, you know, that we have literally a major segment of our country, and I got into it a couple times there with some people that, you know, we are willing to pronounce judgment, to say you're guilty until proven innocent, you know. That is a disastrous direction for our country. That, you know, on the basis of an accusation, a man's life is, they will, with full intent of destroying his life and his children and his wife, based on an accusation that has no grounding evidence. I don't know. Did something happen to the girl? Heard an interesting explanation last night. You know, it's pretty tough because oftentimes in, psychological, did something happen to the girl? I don't know. Maybe. But oftentimes in psychological evaluation stuff, they put you under hypnosis. And oftentimes in hypnosis, you come up with some things that have nothing to do with truth, but you absolutely believe them to the depths of your core after that in your evaluation doing it. You know, do I think that she maybe was sincere in believing something? But there's no collaborating evidence. Nothing. In fact, there's 60 women that have come forth and no people to collaborate. So, no people to collaborate that. I mean, is it, I don't know, Jane, what's your take on that? What's that? No, not the hypnosis stuff. Just more the Kavanaugh stuff. I mean, here's a boy who has probably is upstanding of a record. In fact, I would contend that probably nobody can sit in this room as boys and have that kind of record as that boy has. You know, do I think he's without sin? I don't. I don't think he's without sin. But he has a record that's unbelievably upstanding. You know, and You know, did something happen in high school? I don't know. But there's nothing to collaborate what it is. But the amazing thing to me is we as a culture are willing to... I don't think there's ever been a more qualified Supreme Court justice. Okay? I mean, when you look at his history, when you look at his record, when you look at his experience, when you look at everything about him, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the guy is an upstanding guy. But he is guilty. I mean, the people, there was a group of five women from that I get into with. He's absolutely guilty. How do you know he's guilty? Because she said. But there's no collaborating evidence. She doesn't even know where it was, when it was, when it happened. And there's nobody to collaborate the story. And the people she says should collaborate the story that were there at the time say it did not happen. Say that did not happen to you. And yet, okay, but we as a country are willing to crucify the man, are willing to destroy the man. Why? At least at this point, everyone would say because we want a liberal judge, because we don't want to ruin our right to abortion. We want a liberal court. We want a liberal court. And will Kavanaugh be able to overturn that? No, that's a ridiculous thing too. Okay? But will it happen? Will it not happen? But many other, you know, the left-wing liberal side has controlled the court for many years. And they did during Roe versus Wade. And we went into Roe versus Wade. We put Roe versus Wade. And we've thrown 60 million children in the Nile. Since Roe versus Wade. We've thrown 60 million children in the Nile. Now we'll read this story and say Pharaoh said, throw the children in the Nile, okay? We go, oh, how barbaric! You couldn't do that! How could we do that? We could never do that, right? How could those people even do that? How could they respond to that? How could they accept that? We've accepted it. You know? The Nile's a great place. I don't want to hear them scream long. You know? There's, what did I read? There's 600 million pounds of water per minute that go through the Nile. I mean, it's unbelievable. The Nile's big. 4,000 miles long, longest, giant, giant mass of water, you know, that flows, you know, into the Mediterranean Sea. You know, just a giant mass of water. And they don't hear them screaming, you know, just like we don't hear them screaming, right? I mean, and they accepted this for an extended long period of time. And God said enough. God predicted this 400 years plus before. 500 years probably before, okay? He predicted they would act like this, they would oppress these people in this way, and he would destroy them for it. I do not think that God, and, you know, I'm not the date guy doing it, you know. I have no problem believing we might drag on for another 100 years or two. Not this country necessarily, but this world. You know, who knows? You know, everybody since the first apostles were absolutely convinced Jesus was coming back in their lifetime. I don't think there's ever been a generation that didn't have those who felt that way. Okay? Could he come back in our lifetime? Yeah. He come back in our lifetime. You know, I don't predict, I'm not predicting that. You know, one of the tragedies for me is when I look at eschatology in the end times, I don't see the United States in there. You know, I don't see the US in eschatology in the end times. Okay? I mean there's a lot of talk about what happens and fairly vivid descriptions, fairly intricate descriptions, but the United States, this power doesn't seem to be, and at this point, we are still the strongest power in the world. Okay? We are still the strongest power in the world. That would entail to me that we're gonna collapse before the end time. That's just David, that's not this, okay? That's David thinking that. But it just doesn't seem that we hold time. But, let me just tell you, us collapsing will make every one of us wish Jesus was coming back. I would contend that we are heading in a very, very ugly direction. You know, there's some things and aspects about our culture that are moving very out of control very quickly. Very, very quickly. You know, again, Roe versus Wade. When I was a kid, you could not have imagined that. Well, people were dying, you know, but think what happened in back alleys, and women were, there wasn't 60 million. You know, is that a horrendous thing? There's a way to fix that. Don't have sex outside of marriage. Don't be immoral. And if you are married and want to abort your kid, don't be selfish. That, you know, there's ways to stay out of the back alley. You know, is that I don't care about those who are, again, don't get me wrong here. Irresponsible men are the issue here. Keep it in your pants until you're married. Be holy. Be pure. Regard women as, you know, one of the most tragic parts of this is we relentlessly ran into couples. Because we were, it's weird, people are weird in campgrounds up there. You know, I don't know if they're that way everywhere. I don't spend much time in campgrounds. I love being out, but it's never by a campground if I can help it, okay? But it's weird, you know, you got these people camping, you know, next to you. And everybody just whispers. I think we're talking about it because it's past school season now. There wasn't any kids riding their bikes around. There wasn't kids running around and stuff. So probably somewhat different. But everybody's very quiet. Nobody talks. Everybody's whispering. But so we went and talked to them. So I'm talking to the neighbors next door, you know, and, you know, meeting them and who are you and what are you and stuff. And I mean, it was relentlessly, almost without exception, people who had been a guy and a girl who had been dating for X amount of years, 5 years, 7 years, 2 years. Not married, you know, and traveling together, you know. And every one of the girls wanted to be married. Because I pushed the issue, you know. I'd say, well, what's his problem? You know, you seem like a good girl. I don't know, just, you know, kind of here hoping, you know. You know, if we go to some really beautiful place like Banff or Jasper, some extreme place like this, maybe you'll be inspired to be romantic or something, is basically was the implication. Relentlessly was the implication. But it was men, is stinking, I want to punch them in the face, you know, and go, why did you, you're sleeping with this girl, you're having sex with this girl. Why would you want to take the responsibility to marry? You know, in an extreme place, having sex with this girl, and, you know, she's willing because she's hoping that you'll be inspired to marry her. You know, I mean, is this a sick thing? Men being irresponsible. You know, it's sad. You know, and the girls relentlessly. I mean, I don't know how many girls. You know, but there was a, you know, that said that same thing. That's what they're there for. That's why they were in Banff there. That's why they were in Jasper. That's why they were working there, following their boy there, hoping, and Marion doing this. And it was stinking, selfish, narcissistic men, you know, that end up creating and then putting a woman in a position of murdering her child, throwing, you know, and yet saying she can't even deal with it. I would say it's worse than the Nile. You know, these weren't, I mean, there was an implication of immorality involved with Jewish people, okay? This wasn't babies out of wedlock or unwanted kids, okay? The implication would be that these are children born in a marriage. And children born in a loving, healthy marriage. The thing that I would like to create, and again, I don't want to ruin your Sunday school version of a little baby Moses. Because, I mean, I have this, the Sunday school version, flannel graph version of little baby Moses in the reed and cute little basket and these pretty girls walking by the side of the stream and, you know, it's all roses and sweet and saving. Are you kidding me? Listen to this, man. This is a mother who put her child in a basket to die. Because she couldn't quite bring herself to throw him in the river. I mean, it's horrendous. And the sister is there watching the child die. This isn't a cute little story for little kids. This is as black as it gets. I don't know how many you saw floating down the Nile. Maybe the water was fast and murky, man. Maybe the crocodiles, you know, that were good enough and ate them quick, you know. I don't know. You know, but this is a black time of years and years of this oppression happening to this people. And, you know, I'm honestly baffled a little bit about this story and haven't come up with answers yet. Maybe as we continue to go, and I've tried to figure out what it is, but, you know, besides the grace and mercy and goodness of God that he spared Moses. I mean, the story is actually an unbelievable miracle. Okay? I mean, the baby was not put there to keep it. The baby was put there to die. Okay? And that it's a miracle that the baby's, Moses' mother, was even able to not only see this baby redeemed, but, you know, this is darn near, you know, it doesn't even name them at the beginning, you know, it says that they were a couple, Levites that were married and had a baby. And this is a woman potentially, you know, I get the impression of pretty righteous. I get the impression of pretty blessed by God, you know, I have this sense of a Mary type, you know, I mean, that's, you know, they went against the king's edict. I don't know what the price was. But I mean, this had to be a dark thing. This wasn't like, try to hide yourself from the cops. This was like your neighbor can come and take your baby out of your arms and throw it in the river. I mean, can you imagine? And you fight this and you were going against the edict of the king? This is a time of ugly, you know, we're in a time of just as ugly. You know, it would be interesting to know how many, you know, babies were. I mean, obviously there was 600,000 men that came out of Egypt, okay? And this was an 80 minimum, if not 90 year period, probably 90 to 100 year period, okay? This was going on since the edict happened. It was 600,000 that came out. Men. So I'm not exactly sure if that was all those babies that were just saved or what was happening. What was acceptable or what wasn't acceptable. Because the Jewish women were killing their sons. That is a given. Everybody didn't completely disregard the edict of the Pharaoh. That didn't happen. Okay? Wouldn't have happened. Okay? This is, probably looks a little bit different than what we think. You know, we think of this as the Pharaoh's daughter, because that's what it says. Okay? Let me read these verses in chapter 2, the first 10 verses. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child in it, and she set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Yeah. Traumatized beyond belief. Her brother was just put out to die. Is a crocodile going to eat him? Or is he going to float down the river and be gone? Or, I mean, the little sister? I mean, who knows? But my assumption is she's cognitive, at least, to run and talk and speak to the princess and do it, you know, 10 years old, out of who knows what. And she's sitting there watching to see what, just, I'm sure, mom was home crying. She's, you know, traumatized. Yeah. It's a, yeah, and you have those mother instincts naturally. Here's your baby brother there. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, and with her maidens walking alongside the Nile, and she saw the basket among the reeds, and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it and saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew woman, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called. Can you imagine the elation and praise and wonder? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." So I think the picture of this, and putting it there, it looks a little different. Probably there was, you know, at the time, Egypt was probably the wealthiest, most powerful nation on the earth. They were, you know, profoundly wealthy, and profoundly powerful. And like our guys do to some degree, they had different, capitals. It wasn't just Ramses, you know, they had different places where they had their places. And where this probably happened, was in one of their outlying palaces that they had, potentially a hunting camp. That's not just David wishful thing. It wouldn't be wishful. I don't care about that. But the Egyptians used to hunt, and fish, with bows a lot. They hunted birds, with bows and fished. And that was, they were definitely sporting people at the time doing it. But it was probably one of these sporting places there. At all the different castles, they had harems. Because that's what it was. I'm not sure what. I would say, why wouldn't you? But I'd say, why would you? You know? But anyway, I can't quite imagine that. But anyway, they had harems, and they had different. And in that, there was a strata of principals, you know, primary wives, primary, you know, closest, and then concubines, and then servants and things. I mean, at all the different castles. This is probably not at the palace. This is probably an outlying one. She was regarded as a daughter. The word is said as a daughter. She was one of those daughters of Pharaoh. Probably offspring of him, you know, but not necessarily directly the king's daughter that was, like, we think of family as a cohesive husband, wife, couple of kids thing. This is one of the daughters of Pharaoh in a far off place. It's probably why she was able to pull this off. You know, and make it go. In those places, they were highly educated. You know, they had tutors and they had sitters. And they were busy places. They were places of commerce. They wove and they did all kinds of stuff in those places. They weren't just places of idleness, from what history we have now looking back on it. So here's this daughter of, one of the daughters of Pharaoh, a princess, obviously a high-ranking princess enough to do it. So obviously from one of his primary wives, or however you would stratify that. In the mix of things, and she saw this baby there, and there it was. So, you know, there's a couple of things about this that I don't understand, and I was hoping that by this time I would have a good answer and be able to tell you and explain it to you, but I don't yet. So, you're going to have to wait or see what happens, or why don't you guys figure it out, okay? But, you know, there's a verse here. It says, "But a woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months." And, you know, it's difficult for us. I mean, God is not a God of, you know, favoritism. You know, I know that. You know, I contend she was a godly woman. You know, the word actually beautiful means pleasant, agreeable. Good is actually a direct translation, but pleasant and agreeable. Not necessarily have to do with facial expressions doing it. You know, my wife and I have talked about this quite a bit. I would assume it was a quiet baby. You know, because how else do you deal with it? Not a Naomi, you know, something. You know, it was a quiet baby would be my assumption from the standpoint that, how else, you can't, a colicky baby or something. I mean, you know, everybody knows it's, you're going to hear it. You know, you're going to know that there's a little baby and know if it's a son or a daughter or what it is. And if you're going to throw it in the deal, maybe that's where they got dressing little boys like little girls for those pictures, you know, doing it or something. You would try to hide your kid, you know, or something. I don't know. But they, you know, you couldn't disguise. I would assume that's my speculation again, Bible over here. It says good, agreeable is really what the word means in Hebrew. Okay. Not necessarily a beauty. You know, the sad thing to me is, I mean, finish that sentence out, you know. So what if it wasn't agreeable? What if it wasn't good? You know, what if it was colicky? Then you threw it in the river, you know, cast it in the Nile. And again, this is not about condemnation of anyone here. All of us in this room have been affected in a big way somehow by abortion. I know that. That's just the way it is, okay? All of us. We've known someone, whether we've known they have or not, we know people, we are in relation with people that have been traumatized by abortion. Okay? It's just the way it is, okay, in our culture. It's the overwhelming effect in our culture is profound. And yet we're silenced. Yet we are quiet about it. You know, we accept it. And again, you know, we even live, you know, our abortion even has this initial element of guilt and shame with it because of immorality or, you know, why did I do that? Or how stupid was I? Or, you know, why did I make such a bad judgment call with that idiot or whatever it might be? Okay. But still all of us, and yet, we live in a very, do not try to cover it over. You know, we live in a very, very dark age. That is look at this unbelievable, irresponsible lack of integrity with those who are supposed to have the highest of integrity in our court system. You know, you've got these highest, see you, Natalie. We've got these highest officials, the most honorable of which are senators, that are sitting on a committee to determine the ethics and morals of a Supreme Court justice. So these are supposed to be our highest guys, right? The guys that are most capable of making such a decision. Have any of you watched it? It is unbelievable the way that, I mean, there's definitely a boom left and right thing, you know, on doing it. But it is unbelievable how they treat Kavanaugh. You're a liar. You know, I mean, just, you know, this guy's a white privileged male that's taking advantage of this poor girl. And I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's all about abortion. And for them, they won't even identify with the fact that they would never say it's about killing babies. Right? They would say it's about protecting the rights of my constituency. It's all about getting reelected. It's all about politics is what it's about. That's all it is about politics. But in the process, it's about murdering children. Innocent children. And we have so distanced ourselves from the willingness to face that. That tells you how dark and deprived we've become. And we accept this and we exonerate this and we... Our highest level of people that we put in a position to have ethics and morals and values and make judgments and determine law and right and wrong in our country are fighting this way. I mean, we are in a very, very dark age. You know, we look at this age and say, that is so dark. We are darker. We are darker. This isn't even by command of the king, man. This is by individuals making a choice of, I don't want to be troubled by this child. I'm going to kill you. You know, and again, as we talked last week, the searing of our conscience is something that we should all consider. Because if anyone in this town or this country took their one-year-old child and put him outside on a cold winter night and let him die because they couldn't handle him anymore. They couldn't take care of him. They couldn't deal with the stress. Let them outside. We would hang her. We would hang her. That would be the worst, terrible, ugly person you can imagine that she did that. What is the difference? There is none. There is no difference. And how callous have we become? We still stand on high moral ground about morals, right? I mean, some gal in Texas a couple years ago drowned her kids in the bathtub or something, right? She's a wicked, unhuman. Right? You guys remember that? I mean, she's non-human. You couldn't do that. How could you do that? And yet, if she'd had 5 abortions, we would stand up in the Supreme Court and defend her. No, this is completely valid and good. Yes, ma'am. I believe that. I believe that. What's that? Yeah. I mean, it's. I believe that. I mean, it is so sideways as far as what we find acceptable. You know, and what do we do, and how do we deal with and fight? I want to remind you one thing that became pretty profound to me. In reading this, God used, in spite of the women being completely disregarded by the idiot men Pharaoh and seeing as lower than life, you know, he didn't care. Keep the women here because we'll use them for multiple wives and concubines and labor and all kinds of stuff. We can use the women. We don't have to fear them and worry about them, right? They're not going to join forces and army against us and kill us. We can just use them for ourselves and for trade goods and for all kinds of stuff like that. Doing it. It's just amazing to me that God used women to save and redeem the nation Israel. Her mother that went against the king's edict, her sister who stood there by the bank in complete trauma, but she couldn't stand, you know, waiting for her brother to float down the frickin' river and be gone and die. This little girl, he used this princess. You know, this woman there and the maidens that were there to rescue, to be used by God. God used them. I mean, like God, but I mean, God used them. God used these women to redeem, to save the nation Israel from slavery. What? The two midwives. The two midwives are two primary ones. You know, this kind of started the whole thing. He used them to save it. I mean, here's these two midwives that went directly against the king's orders to kill the babies. You know? I mean, so they stood against this horrendous, barbaric action. And God blessed them for it. God blessed all of them for it. Can you imagine his mother getting to nurse Moses again? I mean, that would just be overwhelming. She put him, sealed him in this reed basket to die. That was his coffin, alive. Put him there. And then she gets to nurse him and know that he's going to grow up. I mean, oh my gosh. But that is, yeah, grandson of the king. But God is like that. When things seem the darkest and the worst, do we stand on God's side? Do we make a stand for what is right and what is wrong? You know? I mean, I'll be honest with you, man. I mean, the only thing that probably drugged my, no, probably not the only thing, but the primary thing drugged my humiliated, embarrassed butt to the polls a year or so ago was Supreme Court justices. And knowing that this next president was going to appoint a couple, and it was going to have a powerful effect on our country for the lifetime of my grandchildren and my children. Okay? The things that were going to be come up. And I went knowing that there was a much better chance, there was a probability that Trump was going to place men like Kavanaugh there, in spite of his buffoonery. He was going to place a man like Kavanaugh, who is not a buffoon, who is a man of everything, everything points to a man of great integrity on doing this, and fairness in his judgments and what he does, and great intellect. Very, very important. Are we willing to fight against that? I mean, we live in a country, there was some gals sitting there, a bunch of 30-year-olds there celebrating their, five of them sitting there celebrating their birthday. One of them's birthday, and so they were in Banff, and they're from Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, and we talked a little at first, you know, and stuff, and they, because they were sitting kind of in the booth next to G9, so we talked a little bit, and, you know, they made comments like, oh, I knew we'd like you, that guy, you know, doing it, because they weren't sure, I'm sure, because I look like a man with a cowboy hat or something, I don't know what, but they, or I'm ugly, I don't know quite what, but they were making comments, oh, yeah, I knew we'd like that guy, I knew we'd, you know, do it. Except then I sit there listening to them, and they're going on, you know, because everybody does, and they go to their phone eventually, right? If there's any lull in the moment, you know, you go to your phone and start checking stuff, important stuff. But she's flipping through, and she was talking. She goes off about Kavanaugh. She goes, oh man, I hope, you know, was Ford going to be there? Was she going to be interviewed? Is that today or not? You know, oh, that guy, man, I hope she didn't have to stand for that. I hope she didn't have to be. And the tempo with all of them was Ford was raped by this guy, you know. The Kavanaugh did this, you know. And so I said, so you guys think Kavanaugh did this? The heck you would disagree? You know, how can you say such a thing, you know? I said, you realize there's no collaborating evidence. I'm not saying what happened and didn't happen, but what happened in our country to innocent until proven guilty? I mean, this, because somebody makes an accusation does not mean it happened. And they got violent. They left. We're not going to talk about, we are willing to crucify this man. We are willing to sit here and condemn this man as guilty. We are willing to talk politics, right? But as soon as I had a different side, we're not going to talk politics. That's confrontational, doing it. Condemning this man, who by all standards is still innocent until proven guilty, okay? And all evidence so far, there's 60 collaborating women saying that this is a man of integrity coming up. Every one of the witnesses supposed to be there that were supposedly there have denied it even happening. There is no time, there is no date, there is no place, there is nobody else to collaborate with what had happened. Okay, did it happen? I don't know, I can't say for sure, but to condemn the man, and a man who has an impeccable record, you know, so far, 6 FBI, he's been investigated by the FBI 6 times for positions within being a judge and being in the White House, you know. I mean, he's been through the scrutiny like a few other people on doing it. And there's nothing else coming up on doing it. But yet they were immediately, I mean, that's the state of our country. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to deal with it. We're not going to have a debate. I mean, what happened in our country? It's the same thing with abortion, right? You bring up abortion, it's immediately, boom. We're not going to talk about, does life begin at conception, or does life begin a thing? Let's have this debate. Let's have a no way. You hate men. You hate women. You're a male chauvinist. You're just against them. You know, I told my wife, I said, you might have more, you know, I was a man, so I strike 3 before I started. Okay, I hadn't even swung yet, okay? So I was already in trouble when it came to talking about issues. You don't have any right to talk about women's issues. And it's a profound state. Are we willing to be those people who stand up? Again, evil triumphs when good men are silent. And women. We are in a terrible state these days where men, I mean, it's a radical thing. God, and it's obvious in the Bible. What was the curse of Eve? What was the curse? What was it that God said, because of this curse, she will want to rule over men? Right? It's a curse, right? Does that mean it's that God condemned women to do that? No. God just realized that this was going to be the point of sanctification. Okay? And unfortunately, we have moved to a very degenerate state in our culture where we passive, pathetic men. I think it started. I remember when women said, fine, you're not going to control me. I'm going to go get a job. Oh, good, honey. Give me the remote, man. Go get a job. Life's good. It's not my problem anymore. I don't have to worry about it anymore. I'm not responsible for doing this anymore. A bunch of piece of crap, selfish men, you know, that weren't willing to take responsibility. And then we've slowly just dumbed down to the point where now you have a culture that believes because a woman said it, it is absolutely true. Because a man said it, it's a lie, because men are that way. What are we going to do about this? How do we stand as a light in the darkness? How do we stand as the city on the hill? How are we different? I mean, I'm looking at these ladies just condemn Kavanaugh, right? They're all engaged. At different stages of engagement. No, they're all in relationships, okay? Different stages of relationships. All about a year and a half doing it. And, you know, all hoping to get married. All wanting to get married. You know, I mean, I made some comments about it on the initial part, you know. You know, I think I said something to the effect of, oh, you all look like five fine women that all ought to be married. Yeah, we think so too. Well, good for you. I'm glad you recognize that, David. You know, kind of was their response, right? I mean, they looked at me like, oh, yeah, that's how we feel too, you know, on doing it. And yet, you look at, I guarantee you, the men that they're all dating would not stand to the test that Kavanaugh stood to. And yet they're condemning him and his family and his children doing this, throwing them by the wayside. And yet these men that they're dating, but these men, I guarantee you, I mean, there's a lot of things I wanted to say. I was quiet. I didn't say it. But there's, they have chosen men who are obviously unwilling to be confrontational. They have chosen men who are willing to be passive. They have chosen men who are willing to let them rule. And I would tell you, we're going down a terrible, terrible road. Women are not to be oppressed. Women are to be regarded as to be honored. You know, men are to lay their lives down for women. That is not the issue. It's not about oppression. It's not about chauvinism, because chauvinism is from the pit of hell too. Okay? So is female chauvinism. Okay? How are we going to stand? I guarantee you women, as much as us men, have the ability to stand as beacons of light. Will you be honored and respected? No. No more than we will in our culture. But you have to stand as a beacon of light. You know, Gene and I were talking, David, what did you accomplish? You know, they left. I don't know, man. I hope I put a spark in their butt somehow, you know, to think about. What's that? Yeah. To wait, stop a minute. You know, how can you stand here and act like this? You know, how can you be so hateful towards, because he's a man, of course he's this way. Really? That's how you feel about all men. Yeah. Which is a lie. I mean, the woman is a left-wing radical activist. By all, willing to take one for the team.
Just killing son said that the women were protesting even before the nomination was announced. They had XXX, did this, you know, they were ready to fill in the blanks. That's exactly what they did.
Yeah. No, they were willing, didn't matter who came up, they were going to run the card on doing it. So, but women, yes ma'am? Mm-hmm.
And is the pendulum swinging now so much the other way that this is what we're facing? And that doesn't mean that we weren't in an earth age before. We just switched our age timing.
You know, do I think that men in power have abused that power for sexual? Absolutely. But why would a woman say yes? You know, why would a woman say yes? Why would a woman have tolerated that? Because they have. You know, why would the women have showed up in Harvey Weinstein's room? Okay? You know, Harvey Weinstein ought to be shot. I don't get me wrong. But they're willing. They were willing to go to his room. They were willing to put themselves in that position. And then, you know, who is, you know, because of lack of morality on their side too. But then they're mad that they were used or they were abused or actually they were mad because he didn't come through with what he said. You know, so now they're going to blow the whistle. And I, you know, don't get me wrong, man. I mean, the men know, and I hope most of you women know, that I am an advocate for men dealing with sexual immorality. And I fight for that. And because that is the core of it. They should never put a woman in that. But it becomes suspect all the way along. What was the woman doing in that position anyway? Well, why was that woman putting herself under headship? Why is it to be submissive to their husband? When they work for a boss, that puts them in a suspect place where they're under the authority of their boss. The wives in this are not under my authority. They're under her husband's authority. Okay? But when you put yourself in a position of where you have a boss, that puts you in a precarious position working outside. Because now all of a sudden you're under his authority. And what do you do? And how do you act? And how do you deal with it? I think that becomes some of the question. Of how did we get here and how did we put ourselves here? And, you know, I mean, we've run imbalanced for a long ways to get to where it was. Do I think it's right for man to take advantage of women? No. Have they been doing it since the beginning of man? They have. And have women been using their power to control men by getting a hold of their little brain since day one too? Yes. You know, it goes both ways. You know, in doing it. I mean, again, I call men to under account and to be responsible on it. But, you know, in has there been wrongs? But yeah, but women in the workplace is pretty suspect. You know, I remember as a kid, it changes the dynamic of everything. We've gotten so used to it, and I realized that it's not politically correct at this point. But I remember my dad, there wasn't women in my dad. When he moved to the point of being an engineer in the telephone company, and he was fairly happy as an engineer, and he had an office of 30 guys. And he said, 30 guys, you're fine. You know, we're all fine. Put one woman in there, changes everything. Now everybody's vying for her attention. Everybody's vying for this. Change the dynamics between the guys, change the dynamic between them, changes everything on doing it. Well, and we say, oh, you know, that's just the way it is. That's unfortunately the way we are. And putting it in that environment is pretty tough to deal with. And really tough to deal with in a healthy way. It's just different. Same construction, no different. You know, bring one woman on the job or one woman around or whatever. You know, the guys can get along. They can figure out how to get along. You know, But you throw a woman in there and it changes it. It changes the dynamics onto it. You know, and it's again, it's not women are let, women are to be honored, women are to be esteemed, women are to have their husbands, their fathers lay their life down for them, to be protected, to be adored. It doesn't mean because they're lesser or because they're, it does say they're a weaker vessel. What does that mean? What does that mean on doing it? Where to protect them, where to defend them? Are they less intelligent? Probably more so on the average, more intelligent. Now, it's not a matter of a subcategory of a subperson. It's always been that way. You know, we're a nation gone pretty mad at this point. Pretty incredibly dark. And again, I think we need to look at this story of what was happening with Moses to realize, because the thing of it is God said enough's enough. I wanted to read the story, but we're late, so I won't. But I will, and I would charge you to do it, and I'll read it next week. I won't, but I will next week, was what I meant. In Acts chapter 7, Acts chapter 7, and you guys heard of Stephen? Stephen was a martyr that happened during the early, very early church. He gives a speech. That is pretty profound about the way things go, and he includes Moses in there. Let me just read an excerpt from it. I'm going to read the whole speech next week because it's a great synopsis of God's working in the people. Stephen was confronting the Pharisees, the head people in the Sanhedrin. He was confronting them. He was under judgment, because they said you're a Christian and you're saying that Jesus was the Christ and so you're blaspheming. And so he stood up and made this speech about, and in it he gave the history of Jewish culture and basically representing how the people had always been stiff-necked and resisted God and resisted his spirit. And he got stoned for it. They took him out and killed him for it on the deal. But he, in one part in it, let me just read. Just listen to this. We'll read it next week. I don't know where, because I wasn't intending on jumping in the middle of it. But verse 13. And on the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family was disclosed to Pharaoh. We read that, right? Last week, or a couple weeks ago. And Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down to Egypt. And there he passed away, he and his fathers, and from there they were moved to Shechem and laid in the tomb where Abram had purchased for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor of Shechem. But as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham. I mean, this is what's a profound. God predicted to Abraham. God told Abraham this prediction. It's back in Genesis, I think 15 or something. It says, but as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph, right? And it was he who took shrewd advantage of our race. We think of that just being the oppression and work, right? Because he worked them hard. The inference here is that he took shrewd advantage, like commanding them to kill their children. And traumatized them in a terrible way. And he took shrewd advantage of the race, and he mistreated our fathers so that they exposed their infants and they would not survive. Exposed means put out to die. That's what the word means. Okay? That's the shrewd advantage. It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would, because a father had to do it too. A father, I mean, I can't fathom taking your son. I mean, your infant son just born to you. There is something that is an amazing connection there, and taking them out to die and throwing them in the river. And so they exposed their infants so they would not survive. And it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God. And he was nurtured 3 months in his father's house, and after he had been exposed, put out to die. is the word. Okay? After he had been put out to die, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. So, you know, this was a... We live in this, and we, because of these people, because, again, you know, just the few, the father too, I mean, the father took responsibility. I'm sure if they would have found the son in his care, he'd have been in trouble. But mom, the midwives, the daughter, the little girl, they stood for what was right, in the midst of a very dark place, and God redeemed the nation through it. God had promised this would happen, again, 500 years before to Abraham. I don't know. It was to Abraham originally was given that prophecy that you will suffer for 400 years under the oppression, and then I will take vengeance on these people for acting this way. And I look at that and think that is God's heart. God says he will never destroy the whole earth by flood again, but he's wiped some people off the face of the earth. We need to, you know, we won't go into it, but there's a very important principle oftentimes to understand in the Bible that we lose sight of, and that's that sin gets so insidious within a culture that I would say that the spirit of that sin, I see it in spiritual warfare, the principalities and powers that rule over an area begin to infect people and a fairly universal way. The only way for God to stop that, the only way God stops that is by wiping that people off the face of the earth. By ending it. You say, well, but there's always a remnant. I'm not one of them. I don't believe in abortion. What do you do about it? You stand and let the neighbor grab the baby and throw him in the river? You know, what do we do? You know? I'm not saying that we go necessarily shoot abortion doctors. There are obviously lost souls who don't understand and don't know too. But it's happening right here in this hospital. It's happening everywhere in every life-saving hospital. Okay? What are we doing? The biggest part of what we're doing, we've got a culture that nobody will object to, that nobody will argue with, that nobody will debate with, that nobody will bring it up. And we can't be governed by guilt, because some of us are silenced by our own guilt. What can I say? You can be forgiven by Jesus and understand these people can be forgiven by Jesus and redeemed by Jesus, and that God is a good God who wants to change and save these children. We don't know. You know, the only God knows these babies, you know, what happened to the babies that were thrown in the Nile? I don't know. What happened to the babies that were thrown in the dumpsters or in the hospital? I don't know. I know that God is a just God. I know He's a loving Father. My off the record would be that He is omniscient. You know, that they are still innocent. You know, that they have not rejected Him at this point. I don't know. You know, it's not a... God doesn't give us a whole lot on that in the Bible. What happens to babies when they die? In fact, He doesn't give us anything, really. He just tells us His nature, that He's a loving Father, He's a caring Father, and He's fair, just God. But murder is still not acceptable. And how do we sit by and we're unwilling to even confront because of what? They'll get up and leave. You know, they'll get mad. They will not talk about it. But do we not owe the innocent children more than that? Do we not owe standing for truth more than that? You look at, God honored the people who stood and as a result saved the nation. That would be our only hope, is that we stood and God saved the nation. We can't just sit back and be silent. We've got to be willing to speak for truth. I mean, we're talking. To me, it's no different than if I knew that somebody next door to my house. How is it any different? If I knew somebody next door to my house was beating his wife, you know, and I said, "Well, I don't know. I didn't hear a scream." You know, Or was murdering his children next door? Abusing his children? What are we to do? You know, am I saying that we're to wear billboards or be activists or become, you know, rednecks with guns shooting people that don't follow our way? No, but we're not to be silent with our lives, with the people around us. Because understand, when somebody participates in murder, the devastation on their soul is great too. It's devastating to their soul. The hope of redemption in their life is the great hope that we all hope for. That God can redeem, that God can bring forgiveness, He can bring freedom from guilt and shame. And for us to be silent is to be wicked towards them. And for us to base our response or our actions on their response, or will they like me or they won't like me or I'm going to push them away. I've heard it all my life. Well, you can't push people away because then you have no voice with them to be able to talk. So just be stupid, ignorantly silent and don't speak truth. I mean, there's a time to shut up and there's a time to speak. I know. I'm doing that. But are we moved and led by the Spirit of God to do what He tells us to do in spite of the cost to us? We need to be. We need to be in light of it. So, let's pray. God, You redeemed Your people out of Israel, a stiff-necked, rebellious, hard-headed, hard-hearted people, but You'd called them to Yourself. We can sit here arrogantly and think we're not like them, but we are. We're stiff-necked and we're hard-hearted. We're immoral. We are not living on the level that You've called us to. I am thankful and grateful for Your redemption and Your forgiveness, because otherwise I'd have no hope. You want us to be a different people, a people called to You, no different than You called the people. And you told them how that could look and how that could be. But I thank You that You were willing to hear their cries. You heard those babies scream. I don't know how many babies there were that were put in reed baskets and how many were just thrown in the river and how many hundreds of thousands, because it was probably hundreds of thousands over the years, that were cast in the river. And the screams and the cries and the... You heard them too. And Your heart broke more than ours, because Your heart is not hard. Your heart is not callous. And You've heard the 60 million baby scream in the womb as they were euthanized somehow, cut up and vacuumed or poisoned with salt or whatever. And Your heart breaks. You want Your people to be people that are willing to fight and give their lives up and risk their lives for such things. So God, please call us in spite of our weaknesses to be Your people. To speak Your truth, to live Your truth, to be light in this darkness, because we live in darkness. I thank You for Your word. I thank You for Your promise, Your great ray of hope throughout the Bible, that You are always about redeeming us to Yourself. You are always about calling us to You. I don't understand that and why, because I don't understand that great of love, that great of patience, and that great of forgiveness, that great of willingness to put Jesus in our place and the death we deserve. But I thank You for that. Cause us all to be challenged, not to be complacent, not to be sucked into our culture and our society, which has become very dark and very demented. Not to think we can whitewash it or shine it up, because it's not capable of that. Thank You, Jesus, for Your forgiveness. Thank You that we can be people in spite of our deserving of death, all of us deserving of death. You've died to set us free from guilt and shame, that we can be forgiven, that we can live in power, that we can live with purpose, that we can live in purity. I thank you for forgiveness. I thank you for your grace, your unmerited favor towards us. Amen.